The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Wow. Well, I won't speak for John Adams, but I feel a little overhyped. But nonetheless, very, very grateful for that wonderful introduction. And thank you all for coming. And we just have a very sort of a free form, sort of improvisatory, aleatory plan for the conversation here. And just sort of we'll start talking. And then at a certain point, you can jump in and see where it goes. And I'm just going to start by reading a little bit from my book, since this is a book event, and it's going to be
$29.95.
And it's well, it'll become apparent who it is about. As Highway 1, the California Coastal Highway, goes north of San Francisco, it holds the eyes like a work of art. The landscape might have been devised by a trickster creator who delights in grand gestures and abrupt transitions. Rolling meadows end in cliffs. Redwood trees rise above slender patches of beach. Towers of rock rest on the surface of the ocean like the ghosts of clipper ships. A lost cow sits on the shoulder looking out to sea. Side roads head up the inland hills at odd angles, tempting the aimless driver to follow them to the end. One especially beguiling detour, the Myers Grade Road, departs from Highway 1 shortly after the town of Jenner. The grade is 18%, and the steepness of the ascent causes dizzying distortions of perspective. The Pacific Ocean rises in the rearview mirror like a blue hill across a hidden valley. Not far from here is Brushy Ridge, the forest home of the composer John Adams. One way to describe his work is to say that it sounds like Highway 1. It is a cut-up paradise, a stream of familiar sounds arranged in unfamiliar ways. A glitzy Hollywood fanfare may give way to a trance-like sequence of shifting beats. Billowing clouds of Wagnerian harmony are dispersed by a quartet of saxophones. It is present-tense American romanticism, honoring the ghosts of Mahler and Sibelius, plugging into minimalist processes, swiping sounds from jazz and rock, browsing the files of post-war innovation. Sundry sounds are broken down and filtered through an instantly recognizable personal voice, sometimes exuberant and sometimes melancholy, sometimes hip and sometimes noble, winding its way through a fragmentary culture. So that was more or less how I began a profile of John Adams in that appeared in 2001, I transplanted that bit of the New Yorker essay into my book as the beginning of the final chapter of my history of 20th century music. And there's several wonderful coincidences happened when I finally met John after having listened to his music since college. And one was, I lived in Berkeley for a year after college, not knowing, I guess I was generally aware that you lived in Berkeley, but it sort of never crossed my mind that I was about sort of a half mile or a mile away from your house, and we didn't meet at that time. And then I loved to take this drive up the coast, north of San Francisco, and found this Myers Grade Road detour. And again, I had absolutely no idea that your composing retreat was just a mile or two away from that. So having fallen in love with that landscape, and then having fallen in love with the music since college, it was kind of wonderful to discover how they intersected. But I guess I'll just start by talking about these landscapes and these this sense of the California landscape. I mean, you can certainly talk about it in sort of very cliched things you can say about its connection to your music. Perhaps I've perpetrated exactly that in my book. But has it affected your music on some sort of deep, substantial level?
I imagine it has, although. These things are, I think you use the term refracted you know, you don't want to make too much out of it, or you end up being the California Grieg. and especially with the forest home. You know, I came from, I grew up in rural New England where things felt very nestled and everything was sort of like a Robert Frost poem. You know, the act of crossing the continent, not flying, but going by car and arriving where I knew nobody and had only imagined what the Pacific Coast was like was you know, it imprinted me very powerfully. And I think that my natural attraction to certain composers who think, not maybe in landscapes, but certainly think in terms of very large musical vistas, composers, you know, like Sibelius or Bruckner or, you know, a lot of the German composers who love to make very large structures. My affinity for that, and then the profound effect that the California landscape, not just the littoral, not just the coast, but you know, the deserts and particularly the Sierra Mountains. Yeah, I suspected it had an effect on some pieces, not all, but some of them.
Right, I mean, there's sort of maybe urban moods, and then sort of you know, a wide landscape moods in your music as well. Yeah, the one wonderful thing about your book is it's not only sort of the memoir of a composer and sort of your sort of, you know, development, listening to music, playing music, and writing music, but it's also a memoir of a guy growing up in the 60s, in a way, and I think there's material there which is just wonderfully evocative of that period. So, I mean, maybe to give a taste of your book, is there something there you might want to read from the from the 60s area?
This is my book. $26. But it's only 338 pages. Hallelujah Junction. Hallelujah Junction actually is a place. Speaking of landscape, it's a little tiny, basically a crossroads in the High Sierra Gold Country, typical, you know, 49ers kind of name. And when I drove by there, I thought, oh, there's a perfect title, Looking for a Piece. So first I used it as a piece, and then I used it as the title of the book. I guess I should just rewind a bit by saying what I was trying to achieve in this book. My ideal reading audience for this book is actually you know, people in their 20s, people who are interested in really want a career in the arts, not necessarily composition, but I've tried to be as honest and candid and, you know, at times very self-critical about what it was like when I was 20 and when I had, even when I was 14, and had fantasies of becoming a composer, the kind of things that I went through. I mean, there's a description in the first chapter about this alter ego that I had. I had a second personality. I gave him a different name, and you know, I had a paper route. And when I did this paper route, every night I would compose a different piece and keep an opus numbers and. And then I talk about, you know, years in college. And I was in college during the late 1960s, which was an extraordinary time, not only politically, because of the Vietnam War, and socially because of, you know, that was a period of explosion of, you know, the social protest movement, but also, you know, mind-altering drugs, Timothy Leary, LSD, But it was also the period when people started talking about ecology for the first time, it was a really seminal time, as my children never tire of hearing me talk about. So here's a little snippet from the second chapter. The chapter's called From Help to Let It Be. And that sort of bracketed my college years. Help was the Beatles movie. There was also a song. And I saw that my first night as a freshman at Harvard. And Let It Be was what I call their terminal anthem of resignation and valediction, which was in the stores just before I left Cambridge and came to California. Back in the dorm room and at all-night parties of pot, scotch, whiskey, and unfiltered Lucky Strikes, we bored like weevils through the harmonic changes and textual minutiae of albums by the Paul Butterfield Blues Band, Rashaan, Roland Kirk, Bob Dylan, Cream, Jefferson Airplane, The Electric Flag, Country Joe and the Fish, The Beach Boys, The Doors, and, of course, Jimi Hendrix. I would fall asleep on a hardwood floor of my friend's room with my head wedged between a pair of stereo speakers as if they were headphones. And I would wake up in sweaty clothes, smelling gamey, my glasses bent out of shape, and find that I was already late for class. I made more progress in my command of harmonic practice by reproducing these pop songs from memory at the piano than I ever did by my forced marches through the figured bass treaties. More than any other social phenomenon of a socially phenomenal era, rock music was the fulcrum of a culture. Young people communicated to each other through the medium of its lyrics, especially those by Bob Dylan and John Lennon, and its intense emotionalism seemed to speak for our common experience and what we imagine to be our universally held beliefs. What particularly enchanted me about the popular music of the time was its harmonic ingenuity, something that was fresh and inventive in the late 60s, although it would soon become routine and predictable within a short span of 5 or 10 years. A song like Brian Wilson's Good Vibrations took the standard pop song through a tonal hall of mirrors, moving into remote keys with an effortlessness that gave the music its feeling of endless delight. Wouldn't It Be Nice, another Beach Boys song by Wilson, begins with an 8-bar introduction in A major played on the harp, which is then followed by a single thwop on the drum and by the main tune in the remote flat submediant key of F. This kind of tonal surprise was nothing new in classical music or jazz, but appearing here in the context of a standard rock and roll song, it felt novel and fresh. More than any other songwriter of that era, Brian Wilson understood the value of harmonic surprise. The Beatles, too, even from their earliest days, demonstrated an exceptional harmonic imagination. And as their message matured, their vision became increasingly complex and shaded, their harmonic world ever richer. Songs on what we knew as the White Album and on Abbey Road went deeper in every sense, emotionally, psychologically, harmonically, textually, and in the incredible wit and invention of their sound world. The LP album went from being a simple reproduction of a live performance, as it generally was in the jazz and classical traditions, to a studio creation, a thing in itself. The final song on Sgt. Pepper, beginning with John Lennon's world-weary, "I read the news today, oh boy," ends with a swirling vortex of electronically manipulated sound that suggests the planetary visions of Stockhausen's Hymnen. These Beatle albums significantly altered the notion of what a recording was about, and they proposed that the studio itself, with all its technological powers of transformation, could be a locus of artistic creation, representing a new reality, just as the film editing studio had become in the hands of the great directors. We listened to the George Martin produced albums in a state of astonishment. The sound world was completely new, with its close mic, uncharacteristic instruments like the scraping, hacking cello of I Am the Walrus, the chirping piccolo trumpet of Penny Lane, and the chugging string quartet behind Eleanor Rigby.
think it's already better than most writing that exists about the Beatles. But so set the scene. I mean, it's fascinating sort of where you are in your development at this point, because you've sort of grown up with a lot of mainstream, just sort of 18th and 19th century repertory, as well as just a lot of sort of classic American music, jazz, musical theater, and so on. And then you're sort of creeping into the 20th century, sort of early 20th century music, maybe in your teens. And then you sort of, you get to Harvard, and all of a sudden you're plunging into the thick of, you know, popular music on the one hand, the rock, the rock explosion of the mid and late 60s, but also the 20th century avant-garde, and Boulez and Cage and Stockhausen and so on. How did it feel like sort of negotiating this? I mean, this has been an incredibly charged and complex moment in musical history, where these things are, and they're moments of connection, as they say. I mean, the Beatles were actually listening to a bit of Cage and Stockhausen, and it's reflected in their music. But was it also sort of tremendously confusing to go back and forth between, you know, late nights in the dorm with the rock records and what you're doing, studying by day?
Yeah, I think cognitive dissonance is the appropriate term. It's very hard to describe how upsetting and confusing the situation was in the late 60s, because, you know, if you wanted to be a serious composer and you went to a school that was interested in cutting-edge aesthetics, the models were, they started with Schoenberg and Stravinsky, and, you know, my professors at Harvard were in their 60s, so for them, Boulez and Stockhausen were, you know, questionable figures. So, I mean, we spent most of our time hearing about Schoenberg and Webern and Berg, and then, of course, to be radical and rebellious, we would listen to Boulez and Stockhausen. I really liked, that was a period of Stockhausen before he discovered that he actually was from another constellation. And I did like, you know, there was a romance to his early work, the pieces like Hymnen, which is this amazing, big, sprawling tape composition that it really is as if you're circling the globe in a space capsule. And Hymnen, of course, means anthems, you know, national anthems. And you hear these, they're like fractals, little tiny little snapshots of national anthems sort of coming up from the surface of the planet and whizzing by you. And all of that's mixed in with this, classic early 60s tape music. You know, this is in the era before synthesizers, so it was had a wonderful excitement to it. But the general aesthetic philosophy of contemporary music in that period was really pretty grim. I mean, atonality was absolutely de rigueur. As well as I would say, aperiodicity. I mean, the models that we were sort of, you know, we as students established it. People say, well, John Adams suffered from academic composer teachers, but it wasn't the teachers that caused me to suffer. It was my classmates because you know, there's nothing more didactic and more intolerant than your roommate. You know, your classmates, and they were picking up all this, you know, very, very cerebral and difficult music from, particularly coming from Germany, what was called the Darmstadt School, which is, you know, anyone involved in using music kind of as a means to push every imaginable envelope, you know, music that was unbelievably long or unbelievably loud or unbelievably complex or unbelievably
soft
or, you know, or unbelievably simple. And so it was a period of just, you know, pressing every imaginable button. And it wasn't just music. I mean, Julian Beck was doing it in theater, and William Burroughs was doing it in literature.
So you were really an enthusiast for
I was
for this.
Very, you know, I didn't really like it. I kept telling myself that I liked it, but I was going back to my room and listening to Jimi Hendrix. Right. And finally, at some point, I said, what's wrong with this picture? And that's part of the reason why I did this big romantic gesture and left the East Coast and went to California.
One of my favorite moments in the book is you've been reading the writings of Pierre Boulez at one point, his polemical and analytical broadsides that were collected in Notes of an Apprenticeship and other books, and you know, the proclamation that anyone who hasn't come to terms with the 12-tone method is useless, and so on. And
you should
at one
say
point,
that very explicitly.
So at one point, and then you'd had this brief contact with Leonard Bernstein at Tanglewood. You'd met him at Tanglewood.
No, I actually met him at Harvard.
At Harvard. And so at one point, you actually wrote a letter to Bernstein reprimanding him. You tell the story yourself.
Well, this is when I was a freshman, and I had not met him at that point. But of course, he was a huge figure in my, you know, he loomed like this because I'd grown up listening to his radio broadcasts from the New York Philharmonic and watching the children's concerts, and I was getting listening to all this really hard. Core dissonant music, and being told by my friends and telling myself that this is the real thing. And then I heard a brand new piece by Bernstein called Chichester Psalms, which I was appalled by. I have to say I still am, but it was very treacly sentimental, gooey piece, and you know, it was tonal. And it was very romantic.
Key signatures.
And I wrote him a letter, you know, and I scolded him. And he wrote me back. God bless him. And he was very honest. I'm sure it hurt. I'm absolutely sure it hurt for him to receive that letter. And he, you know, he basically said, I need to do what I'm, you know, what I have to do. And I didn't know at the time that particular year, which would have been 1966, was a year that he had taken a sabbatical, and he wanted to compose a very serious work. And he, exactly that time, had gone through this enormous personal crisis about atonality, and he'd come out of it with Chichester Psalms, which was his statement of belief in tonality and you know, emotional directness.
You know, it's interesting because we've been listening to up in New York. There's been this big Bernstein festival, and you know, of course, it is an uneven body of work, and it sort of has its ups and downs. But it is remarkable how he was really trying to carry on this sort of total synthesis of American sounds, or sort of almost, you know, all sounds, kind of the European tradition together with sort of the American. Popular and classical traditions, and sort of bring it all together as Ives had tried to do in some way, in his own way, and Gershwin in a very different way. And I mean, looking now at his sort of overall achievement, I mean, how do you feel about the sort of the mission that he was on? I mean, there's a sort of this dream of synthesis, but it can be very difficult to execute in an artistically satisfying way.
Well, the bottom line is that orchestral music is a European art form. And I suppose one could say the novel is a European art form, and yet we have our Faulkners and Hemingways and, you know, our more modern, wonderful novelists. So, you know, it just because an art form originated somewhere else doesn't mean that they own it. You know, and sometimes a new culture appropriating an art form breathes life into it. But it's been a difficult marriage for American composers because You know, American, we are a phenomenally musical culture, but we, our culture is so strongly based on its black roots and its folk roots and its ethnic roots. And to the extent that American composers attempted to make symphonies and concertos, but that had an American feel to them, composers like Roy Harris or William Schumann or Walter Piston or, of course, Copland, who was the most successful. You know, it's as you say, Alex. It's about Bernstein. I think it applies to all of us that it's an uneven accomplishment. And I write quite a bit in my book about Charles Ives because Charles Ives, in a way, would be the ideal godfather. You know, if you read his biography, he was just this kind of spotless moral icon. You know, he was a profoundly thoughtful person. He loved the transcendental philosophers. He was a good businessman, but at the same time, he gave away all his money. He cared about the country. He drafted an amendment to the Constitution. He wrote letters to the politicians. You know, he behaved in every way like a great American. But the music is disturbingly unsatisfying for me, most of it. And I try to analyze why that is. In many cases, it's, you know, he was very, very, very experimental in his thinking, but he didn't hear his work. So he, you know, America didn't have a culture in the way that Mahler had. Mahler could write something and then he could hear it within a year or two, but Ives never got to. So it's a real problem, but Bernstein, for me, was at his best when he was most comfortable, and I think he was most comfortable writing show music. And I think he was one of the absolute preeminent songwriters. I mean, he didn't write anywhere near the number of songs that the Gershwins or Cole Porter or Richard Rodgers did, but the songs that he wrote for On the Town and West Side Story and Candide are just, you know, among the best we have.
Yeah, actually, just last night I saw the revival of On the Town in New York, and it's just such a fabulously, you know, confidently put together show. This may be an irritating question, but I mean, of all the sort of your predecessors in American music, is there sort of a single figure, flaws aside, that you just feel most drawn to or sort of sympathetic to on some deep level? Is it Ives or is it Copeland?
No, I think it would be Duke Ellington. Because Ellington, first of all, he was just married to his creative life and also to his band. I mean, that was all there was for him. He was like, you know, Bach or Mozart, and he just produced sort of just, you know, like a hen laying eggs. I think he did a better job of synthesizing his experience, all the different kinds of influences. Later in life, he showed his absorption of the European classics, not only in his sort of cute pieces like the Nutcracker, his Nutcracker version, but the way he integrated contemporary composers like Stravinsky and Debussy into his later pieces. What's also wonderful about Ellington is that he was an entertainer, and he viewed music as great art and entertainment. And I think that's something that 20th century composers lost track of. Mozart viewed himself as an entertainer. We know that. You know, I mean, his letters to his father were all about, you know, I've just written this piano concerto. It's just going to slam in Paris. You know, Beethoven sort of set the later model of the composer as hero. not as entertainer, but as hero, as prophet hero. But a lot of the great work of the 19th century, you know, Debussy's early work was meant, you know, to be sold and to be played and enjoyed. And I think even Stravinsky felt that way. He was very concerned with you know, maybe entertaining is not quite the word, but he wanted to please his audience at the same time that he gave them something deep. And, you know, contemporary music became this terribly grim scientific experiment, starting with Schoenberg. And that's why Ellington, to me, is the model.
I was reading a Pauline Kael essay the other day and came across this statement that I thought was just fantastic, where she said, "All art is entertainment, but not all entertainment is art." It seems to sum it up pretty well. When you were writing the book, I mean, first of all, what was it like sort of switching from composing to writing? Of course, you've long written program notes for your pieces, which are you know, wonderfully entertaining and elegantly written in themselves, but this was obviously a different undertaking. And as you went back through your own output, was it, how did you emerge from that process? Was it sometimes alarming, sometimes exciting? Do you find yourself sort of looking back over your body of work and seeing it in a different way, having done this?
Well, my book started because someone else was going to write a big biographical study, and I started doing interviews with this writer, and then he things happened, and it was clear he wasn't going to be able to write the book. And by that point, I'd already been on the couch long enough that I was kind of interested in going back over my childhood. Also, I'd read this wonderful autobiography by Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and his book is so humble. And it was full of wonderful stories and incredible people and characters and family and situations. And then over the course of the book, you could observe the birth of this creative personality and see how, you know, he went from this very rich, the fertile humus of his childhood into being a writer. So I was in the midst of writing my largest, this big sprawling opera, Dr. Atomic. It was the most inappropriate time to start writing a book, but actually it was a wonderful tonic, because I would get tired of composing, and I had my laptop on another table. And the other thing is that Alex was writing his book, and he was sending me chapters, rough drafts, and I was able to see another book in formation. Fortunately, you didn't send me the chapter about me, or I would have become very self-conscious. But, I was very inspired, and I miss it now. You know, it's, the book's done, and I wrote most of my book in hotel rooms or whenever I was not able to compose, and I suddenly feel like I'm spinning my wheels now.
I want to open up to questions, but just one more question from me, which is sort of talk about what you're doing right now and sort of a couple of projects that you have in the works. You have an orchestral piece and also a string quartet.
Well, I'm always, either consciously or unconsciously, I have my antennae out for an opera story, because I think it's what interests me the most, and maybe it's what I do best. I mean, I really love writing for the stage, because I think our culture, our American life, is just so full of incredible, myths and people and stories. The atomic bomb is, there isn't a more emphatic image to get people's attention, and it represents so much, both for good and bad, of what Americans, who we are, and it expresses our, the crisis of our culture, and so to write a dramatic work, a serious, not entirely coherent dramatic work about something like that is you know what I love to do. But I also love to write orchestra music, and I just finished a string quartet, which I have not. I've only heard rehearsed, and now I'm writing a symphony, which I call City Noir, and I'm writing it essentially for the Los Angeles Philharmonic, an orchestra I have a long history with, and it's inspired by the noir culture of Los Angeles, not only the films, but the real stories, the Black Dahlia, just that sort of jazzy, somewhat steamy, a little overripe quality that you get. I think that it's a noble thing to try to create an ethnic body of art. Alex has heard me say this many times, that I love what's Russian about Tolstoy and what's French about Proust or Debussy, and I love what's English about Dickens and Elgar and Constable, and what's American about, you know, Miles Davis, and what's Hawaiian about Obama. And I think, you know, art doesn't have to be international. It doesn't have to speak to every. But what much of the flavor of, I mean, if you think of Bartok, much of the flavor of what's so we love about so much of a great art is its local identity. You know, whether it's the Bulgarian and Hungarian peasant music of Bartok, or you know the characters in Bleak House, or the Pickwick Papers, or those strange people that Faulkner has in his character and his stories. And I do think that when art becomes too removed and too abstract and too sort of highbrow, usually one of the symptoms is that it's lost its connection with what I call the demotic or the vernacular.
Well, Obama sounds like a good title for an opera. Lots of Hawaiian guitar. And that. Are there questions? Yep, sir. There's a microphone coming.
What are you listening to these days? What's on your iPod?
Oh, everybody asks me, what's on your iPod? You know, it's really hard to answer that question, because if I say something, then it will take on enormous significance. And, you know, I'm usually a month away from conducting somewhere in the world, so I'm frequently involved in learning a new score. You know, one of my goals in life is to conduct all the Sibelius symphonies, and I did the seventh last summer, so I'm working on the sixth. You know, I listen to ethnic music, and my son, who's a wonderful musician with an enormous range of interests, will send me stuff, whether it's a, you know, Algerian Metallica band, or you know, some electronica piece, or you know, some piece of classical music. So I don't usually like to share my playlists, because they're not cool.
Yes.
I'm curious about your interaction with the person who writes the libretto. Like, who informs whom, or how does that relationship work?
Well, somewhere in the book I say that I think artistic collaboration next to double murder suicide is the most painful thing two people can do together. And the reason for that is that if you have, let's say, a librettist and a composer, I mean, it could be a choreographer and a composer, it could be you know, stage director and an author or whatever. But each artist brings to the table his or her highest artistic principles. It's not negotiable. You know, we're not talking about a bill that's going to go through Congress, and you give me some of that, and I'll give you some of this. We're talking about art. And so it's just very, very, very difficult for two people to, you know, try to collaborate and each give his or her best and have the final product be satisfying. And there are quite a few stories. I mean, later on in my book, I devote several chapters to my operas. And there's one chapter called Technical Difficulties, which is a story of a show that I wrote with absolutely wonderful poet June Jordan, who was also the most famous essayist in African-American culture. And it was not an ideal collaboration, and I think that the work suffered. And you know, who's to blame? It's hard to say. Probably me more than anyone. But it's interesting to read, because it's interesting to read how people got tangled up and how, you know, certain things got in the way. Really basic issues like length, or you know, I hate to say it, but who's the ultimate arbiter? And I have to say that in a work of music drama, the composer is. and there's a reason for that. There's several reasons. One is because music is the most psychologically acute of all the arts. In a sense, music can't represent ideas, but it can represent feeling. And ultimately, feeling wins out. So the composer's choice of, you know, whether it's major or minor, whether it's aggressive or soft or loving, or just the slightest little tiny adjustments in the mood of the music make a world of difference. It's like, you know, having an argument with, you know, your spouse or your partner. You know, are you okay? Why are you saying things like that? You know, I mean, people are so attuned to just the slightest change of tone of voice. And the other thing, the composer's the one that ultimately decides the form, the shape, you know, how long it is, what it's going to feel like. John Cage had this wonderful description of what musical form is, the morphology of the continuity. I really love that, you know. I mean, the way the highs, the ups and downs, and the length of the, you know, the breadth of the work. And, of course, that's really hard for... I had this great, great poet, Alice Goodman, who wrote the libretti for Nixon in China and the Death of Klinghoffer. And, you know, we're on speaking terms now 20 years later. And I write of her very, very fondly in this book. I think she gave me two of the great libretti in all of history of opera. But it was a just... incredibly difficult and painful time for both of us.
Yeah, on the topic of collaboration, to bring up Bernstein again, I was the panel discussion, and Alexander Bernstein, his son, was saying that my father feared nobody and no thing except for Jerome Robbins. Next question?
Yep. You mentioned that when music gets too highbrow and too educated, if you will, that it loses touch with the fundamental practices that get to individuals. And in my real early listening, I'm unschooled in music, but I love it to everything I do. And when I first started listening long time ago, I think it was Chopin, I was 8 or 9, and I actually had to go to libraries and start learning about it. Music now is so accessible that it seems to be changing the landscape of the composer to the point where you have someone like Michael Dougherty, for instance, who is actually building it into his icons of his music, Elvis or Barbie or whoever it is. Do you think that because of the unbridled access and accessibility, that it has the potential of becoming too thin, and that it the education or the structure of it gets sort of blended into the pop culture without direction?
Actually, I'd love to hear what Alex has to say about that, because he writes a lot about that.
I think I feel this problem with works of some younger composers where there's this saturating multiplicity of influences and sounds and possibilities, and you can end up with a feeling of skating along the surface, and it feels like things aren't being sort of fully digested. But that's also maybe been a problem with, you know, younger composers sort of through the ages. They're always very, you know, easily overwhelmed by sort of the possibilities that are out there, and sort of as they mature, then they start to sort of narrow their focus, but to sort of find their core identity and start to exclude just what they don't need anymore. It's a necessary process of maturity. So, actually, I'm not terribly worried because I think, I mean, just sort of real strong artistic spirits will overcome and will assert themselves against this admittedly the sort of din of just sort of absurd, proliferation of music that's out there. But I mean, you at the end of the book, I mean, you sort of touch on this a little bit in terms of how you're reacting to yeah. some younger composers' work.
Well, I think the internet and the explosion of information to the digital era has turned everyone into very selective consumers, not only of products but of art. And, I mean, when I was growing up, you could listen to the radio and hear more quality stuff, whether it was, good rock or, stations that actually played classical music. And so there was something wonderful about the radio because it became very much a chance thing. You know, you'd be driving in your car and you'd hear something amazing. I'd have certain stations that would have a program on once a week that would only do weird music, and I'd always listen because, you might hear something that you could change your life. And that's less apt to be the case now. On the other hand, people share information over the internet, and then, somebody not only will write to you and tell you about this fantastic piece, but they'll also provide a sound clip. So young composers are sharing music, and they're also very specific about how to find something. I mean, the big problem, of course, as we all know with the internet, is just that there's just so much out there that the environment is, as he so eloquently says, it's noise.
Yeah. Well, it's just so hard to make generalizations about what composers these days are doing, because you have some who are sort of just grabbing, sounds from all these different places. You have others, you can just go to a sort of a downtown space and find a 23-year-old composer who's written a piece where, there's 2 minutes of silence and then someone plays a major seventh on the guitar, and then there's, a little noise, and then there's another 2 minutes of silence, and it's this absolutely obsessive, high modernist kind of, experimental.
Sounds very 60s to me. Yeah.
So it's all going. I mean, the thing about the 20th century for me is everything that kind of exploded into being in the 20th century is still alive and well, from kind of English pastoral symphonic writing to sort of downtown experimentalism and everything in between. It's bubbling out there. So the question is, the problem is not so much for the composers. The composers are out there doing their thing, and the problem is for the listeners. How do you absorb all this? You go to the website of the Australian Music Information Center, and you see a list of 550 Australian composers, each of them with 4 or 5 sound clips, and just my mind kind of explodes, and I have to go lie down, so this is too much. Someone in the back. back there.
You've talked about your experience or the influence of popular music on your on yourself, and the name Bernstein. You know, you discussed Bernstein. All art as entertainment. Kurt Weill's name hasn't been mentioned, but it's another example of a classical composer who composed for also for Broadway. Would you ever see yourself composing for Broadway? And if not, why not?
Well, I think that Broadway now is has become just completely controlled by corporate behavior. And song, you know, shows are developed in the way that products are developed. And, I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why it's so rare to have a great original show appear on Broadway the way they did in 60, 70 years ago. I don't think I would go in that direction. I mean, I did it once. I wanted to write a show, and I wrote this piece that it was for sort of Broadway-style actors and actresses, and it had a. I wrote essentially about 20 pop songs. I worked very hard at it. I discovered that writing a pop song was a very, very difficult thing to do, and I understand why really good pop artists sometimes it's 2, 3, 4 years between albums because you just, you know, don't push those things out easily. They have to be original, and they have to be good. But, you know, I think I know what I do best, and I don't think Broadway-style music is probably my thing. Although it's what my mother did, and, you know, she was an amateur stage actress, and you know, that music is really part of my pedigree. The question was, what did I think about the Metropolitan Opera new production of Dr. Atomic? For those who don't know the reference here, Dr. Atomic, I think I mentioned, is an opera that I wrote about J. Robert Oppenheimer and the making of the atomic bomb. And my longtime collaborator, Peter Sellers, with whom I've made all of my theater pieces, made an unusual libretto that was essentially a mixture of poetry, since Oppenheimer himself was an immensely literate physicist who loved poetry, and actual source material. You know, when Edward Teller sings, we actually quote the real Edward Teller. So it's an unusual and controversial libretto. And Peter Sellers did the original production in San Francisco, which is now available on a, I think, really very satisfying DVD. Watching opera on DVD is not my idea of a hot night out. but this is pretty good, largely because Peter himself made it. You know, he didn't hand it over to somebody else to do. The Peter Gelb, I think he basically just wanted his own production. I think he wanted to make a statement. Incoming new administration at the Metropolitan Opera, and you know, the Met is this behemoth. I mean, it's like the Pentagon. They have what, like 26 operas a year that they have to go through just to pay the rent, and much of what they do is just kind of, you know, a routine. And so they only really can only have about a half dozen really new productions. And I think he, you know, he honored Peter's creative work, but he had some problems with the production itself. But I think really deep down inside, he just wanted to have his own new production as a statement of his belief in new American opera. So, it was a new production, and I I found that there were very powerful things in it. One thing I liked about it was that the science was much less abstract, and you really did feel, you were reminded a lot more of the romance of physics, and also of the actual, you know, nitty gritty of what it means to make this bomb. It was a lot more realistic. Peter's production. Well, first of all, Peter's set was very, very sparse, and it really did feel like you were right out there on the floor of the desert. And Penny Wilcox's set, which was designed by Julian Crouch, a wonderful set designer, English, was far more constricting. One of the critics wrote that it looked like a human spice rack. You know, there's two galleries with the scientists in them in the chorus. So it was more constricting, and at times you felt sort of pushed, you know, compacted. But I think that added to the sense of pressure and anxiety. You might want to ask that question of Alex.
Well, do we have time for one more really quick question?
Thank you. I didn't go to that. I couldn't go, and I was very... I'm very, very moved and humbled when students do my work. And, you know, when a student opera, Indiana University or here at Curtis, that's... And I will be conducting The Death of Klinghoffer at the Juilliard School in January, so that'll be really quite an adventure.
Yeah, over there.
Speaking of students performing your work, I have a colleague who sang in the production of Nixon in China in Indiana, and he told me that he learned a great deal about vocal writing from singing in his production of your work. And so I'm wondering, who are your vocal models? And do you think consciously about the design of the voice when you compose your arias?
Well, I'm very pleased to know that your friend felt he learned something from learning Nixon. When I look back over the vocal writing that I perpetrated 20 years ago, I'm appalled by it. I am not a singer. I've never studied singing. I never even sang in a high school chorus. I'm a clarinet player. And, you know, the clarinet has some aspects that it shares abstractly with the voice, but the voice is just a totally different, you know, animal. And I just didn't understand a lot about it. When I wrote for Mao, I had this image of Mao giving these great pronouncements to the people, and everyone would immediately quote him. So sometimes even before Mao sings, the Chinese people in the cast already start quoting him before he's actually said the quote. But it's a very hard role to sing because I have him up. I treat him like a trumpet. And singers, you know, if they're going to go up high, it's a great muscular effort, and you have to come down. And then you can go back up, and then you come down. It's like any physical activity, whether it's pitching a fastball or, lifting heavy weights. You have to pace yourself. And I just really abused the voice. Not willingly, I actually just didn't know. And, you know, the thing is that in my experience, no composition teacher ever taught about writing for voice, basically because they themselves didn't know how to do it. And, you know, I never ever studied, and I studied with some very famous composers. Nobody ever talked about the voice. And so I had to learn by watching my singers kill themselves. And... I think I've I've done much better, but I still, you know, I still make terrible mistakes. Common mistake that I and many other composers do is we're always afraid that the male voice can't be heard. So we always write in a very high tessitura to make sure it can be heard. And, you know, you see a baritone open your score and go, ooh. No. Because, in fact, they can be heard down low, and we just never believe it.
As a younger person, I'm curious what, having been an artist for a while, if you feel like you reach into yourself more for inspiration, or what you look around for in the world, what you pay attention to for inspiration, and what sort of penetrates to you, because there is so much to pay attention to.
What are my sources of inspiration? You know, they come from everywhere. Everywhere. I saw a photo in the New York Times 2 days ago that NASA had re-released, a photo of the moon from the very first, Apollo mission. And it was a picture that we saw all during the late 60s in all the media. And it had the moon and then coming up over the horizon was Earth. And it just got me thinking about, you know, how much I'd love to compose something that was not only about the moonshot and about technology, but about 1969, you know, because that year there was a Vietnam War and there was this and that going on. But then this morning I read an article about Martha Clark's, she's a director and a choreographer, a treatment of The Garden of Earthly Delights by Hieronymus Bosch, and I started thinking, oh, you know, what a wonderful thing to orchestrate, you know, to just do something that was just weird and bizarre and colorful and funny and scary and eerie. So all sorts of things. Ideas just come from the strangest place. And I write a bit about that in this book, about how I believe that, you know, the composer's mind has to be like flypaper. And, you know, the problem with modernism was that a lot of modernist artists, you know, whether they were composers or architects or poets or whatever, they live their life with this sort of exclusionary mindset. Can't have that because it's been done before. Can't do that because it's too much like da-da. And so everything was not this, not that, not that, not that. So you got art that was basically sterile because it just, you know, it was stripped of any fertility or relationship to the past. And I'm just the opposite. My engines get going by stimulus from other music, as well as stimuluses from life, whether it's a photo by NASA or, a story somebody told me, or the sound of an air conditioner, you know, making a weird noise in the other room.
One more question? Yes.
Let's see if I can say this the way I want to. You start at one point. You mentioned Mozart and music of entertainment, and contrasted that with Beethoven as a hero. Well, I might see it as Beethoven as wearing his heart on his sleeve, while Mozart did not. And I'm wondering, there's a balance between personal expression and a kind of an intellectual expression that goes into art. And I wonder if maybe each of you would say something about that.
Well, I think Beethoven was unique because, he lived at a time when the idea of personal liberty was very much in the air. You know, philosophers were talking about it, and, you know, it was Napoleon, was, you know, liberation of the spirit, liberation of the individual, and it led to the cult of individuality, you know, which is basically what Romanticism is about. And then that transferred into the 20th century into sort of the auteur notion that the artist is this godlike figure, and that what it's usually a he in this case, you know, what he does is something that we, you know, we go down at the altar of that artist's, you know, being and his ego and his art, and I think that, you know, is very toxic by the time we get to that level. But what's wonderful about Beethoven is stripping it, you know, moving it away from that, you know, the personal cult worship, and just and savoring the incredible human energy. You know, that it was not so much a means of establishing himself as the greatest composer and the greatest individual. It was just this sense of feeling. And, you know, our music is fundamentally the art of feeling. Other arts make you feel, but they don't make you feel in the way that music does. I think we were talking earlier about, you know, the issue with the librettist, because music is psychologically acute and it's about feeling. And I think that's why we never tire of Beethoven, is because his feelings are so thrilling. You know, they're noble, they're sentimental, they're touching, they're tender, they're striving for the greatest, you know, sense of awareness, and that, and he's got good tunes, good harmonies, and good beats.
Yeah, I mean, I think all music that lasts, that endures, is ultimately intensely emotional. And I think this includes a lot of the 20th century music, the modernist music that I write about in my book. I mean, it does have a reputation of being cerebral and intellectual. But, you know, in fact, when Schoenberg made this leap into atonality, he was... really, an absolute emotional mess, to put it bluntly. His life was in complete chaos, personally and psychologically, and it was an intensely emotional act for him. And you know, there are sort of very powerful emotions driving all this music. Boulez, I mean, obviously the young Boulez was an enormously angry and sort of. You know, there's a strong, violent feeling there, you know, right at the surface of the music. So it's just a question with audiences, you know, this mystery of, you know, how do you connect this music to broader audiences, and will that message make sense? Will that emotion, you know, get across in the right way? And just to bring it back to John's music, I mean, when I first discovered it in college, I'll just never forget it, because I'd been just intensely absorbed in the 20th century and catching up with all these sort of avant-garde developments decade after decade. And I was very intellectually stimulated by all this, and sometimes very moved and thrilled or shocked or sort of otherwise, you know, reacting to the music. But when I, you know, got the LP of Harmony Lehre off the shelf of my college radio station, and there was this picture of the guy with the big glasses, and all right, it looks like my eighth grade English teacher, you know, in a nice way, you know, you know, just a guy kind of writing music. All right, so I put it on, and, you know, immediately this enormous sound hit me, which it wasn't so much a question of the emotion, but the technique with which it was expressed. It was just so clear to me that this was music sort of coming from right here, right now, or actually over there in California, and I was in the East Coast, but it was absolutely contemporary American music in a way that just sort of connected me with me at this gut level. And so the emotion was there, and the technique, and the kind of the sense that this was the right music at the right time, you know, for me and for a lot of people, I think a lot of listeners, as we first discovered Harmonium and Harmony Lehre and Nixon in China, and it's continued that way through the present. So it's quite mysterious, ultimately, I think, this balance of obviously the very powerful intellectual traditions in classical music, as well as the emotional undertow, which is absolutely necessary for the tradition to be maintained and to hold on to its audiences. And this is why we cherish this music.
You know, you're saying it's interesting. When you get to a certain age as a creative artist, you deal with the issue of your body of work. And if you had pieces that are successful when you were young, you love them, but you kind of resent them in a way because people kept saying, oh, I loved Harmony Lehrer, I loved Shaker Loops. And you say, yeah. And you think of, you know, a lot of really great novelists keep producing and producing really quality work. But people, you know, it takes time for people to read all that. Or people get so enamored of a work that was written when the novelist was in his 20s that it takes a long time to catch up. And then there's always this suspicion that, well, you know, the older they get, the more they repeat themselves or the less interesting they are. Fortunately, composers aren't like physicists. We don't burn out. Most of us don't burn out at the age of 25 or so. I mean, Mozart would have gone on and been, I think, an endlessly inventive and meaningful composer if he hadn't died. Mendelssohn, too. But, you know, what's exciting about, you know, many composers is that they can get better as they get older. Hint, hint.
Well, if you get the DVD of Dr. Tomek, I think you'll see that that's exactly the case. And for me, it's perhaps his greatest work to date. But we'll be able to chat more with signing books afterwards. But thank you so much for coming, and thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.